clothing and shelter that we need and take care of a lot of our basic needs much more cheaply. As I mentioned, 2% of the population produces all the food and more than we need right now. That's not necessarily a bad scenario. That's a scenario where we can take care of a lot of these other needs that humans have.
But what about balance? If capital, as you say, is advantaged here, and so it's going to be sucking up these profits out of the machine-made products, those are not in full circulation, or I don't know where they're being reinvested, but they're not paying payrolls for a whole lot of humans because machines are doing those jobs. Is there even enough money in the system for all these Wikipedia entries and back rubs and stories being told and joyful poems to really pay?
Well, one thing that we do know is that America is an extremely wealthy society, and the GDP growth has been quite healthy over
time. You know, that's
time.
The second time you've said that, but that doesn't cut much ice when people aren't sharing in that pie.
Yep.
So what? Hey, if three guys have all the money, who cares if it's a lot of money? If it doesn't get worked around through jobs, through work. Hey, let's stand by. This is really interesting. Andrew McAfee and Eric Brynjolfsson are authors of Race Against the Machine. We got Rage Against the Machine behind us right here. Calm Like a Bomb. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about machines moving deeper into the workplace, taking jobs. We're asking, what will humans do? Eric Brynjolfsson and Andrew McAfee are with me, both out of MIT. They're co-authors of the new book, Race Against the Machine, How the Digital Revolution is Accelerating Innovation, Driving Productivity, and Irreversibly Transforming Employment and the Economy. Let's go to Jennifer in Buffalo, New York. Jennifer, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm actually calling. It's a slightly different take on the issue. I work in education, and right now we're wrestling with the role of measuring student learning.
Okay.
And so the question is, do we measure what's important, or are we measuring what's easy to measure? And so it's kind of creating this feedback loop. We're losing sight of the things that can't be quantified, things that don't fit prettily into spreadsheets or aren't well analyzed by software. And so we're losing track of a lot of the important stuff related to student learning, because we become so dependent upon programs and softwares to analyze the data.
So if that's a metaphor, take it up on up to, I don't know, nationally, globally. What do you take from that, Jennifer?
Well, I think for me, we're losing track of a lot of the things that make school and education so amazing and so powerful, creativity, because we can't quantify it. So on a national level, I wonder if in our quest to get high test scores, high numbers, we're losing track of some of those things that make the American educational system so powerful.
Well, okay. So, Jennifer, thanks for your call. Andrew, Eric, does what you're saying about machines imply that we'd better pay more attention to those real subtle, nuanced, intangible human characteristics that differentiate us from machines?
No, absolutely. She's onto something very important. Certainly, being at MIT, I understand the importance of science, technology, engineering, mathematics, these important technical skills that are driving so much of the economy. But I'm with John Maida, the president at Rhode Island School of Design, who says we need to add an A to that STEM sequence, the A for arts and creativity. That is what is differentiating us. And the people like Steve Jobs and others who have created the most value from technology are the ones who have been able to add an artistic and creative component to it. And ultimately, if we want to benefit from the technology, we can't be racing against them head to head. And we can't even be seceding and trying to go off into a corner where we do things not connected. The big value comes from racing with machines, using machines to help us to do things more effectively.
But how do millions and millions of people do that? You're talking about adding artistry. Well, Steve Jobs did that, certainly. But he's a guy at the top of Apple. He's not a million people. How many million jobs do we need now? I mean, where do we get all those jobs in this environment?
But we still need people to go out there, for example, and examine insurance claims. And increasingly, they're going to have very sophisticated tools to take into the field with them to do that.
So we'll need fewer of them. They'll do it faster.
They'll become more productive.
Okay, so there's a net loss. We already have adjusters now, but there's going to be fewer of them. So I'm still not hearing it.
And I don't pretend for a moment that I have all the answers, or that Eric and I have all the answers for the book. That's why we, in our recommendations, we found it critically important to reduce the barriers to starting new businesses, to bringing entrepreneurs into the country, and to crowdsourcing this problem of where are all the jobs going to come from.
What about this from Muriel? Muriel writes online, how about shorter work weeks and longer vacations that would spread the diminishing amount of work among more people? Machines eventually make production cheaper, so people could still be paid as much, but they'd be better off.
That's definitely
pipe dream.
That's part of the solution. I mean, we used to work a lot more hours, and we shortened it to the 40-hour work week, where it's been stuck for a while. I think everybody would like.
It's been creeping up, I think, not down in recent
while. No, I agree. People want more jobs but less work, and one way to do that is by shortening the work week over time, and I can see that happening. But that doesn't really address the core problem that the jobs do more than just provide food and and money. They provide a way for people to connect. Andy, you had
one of the quotes that guided us in the book was from Voltaire, who said that work saves us from three great evils: boredom, vice, and need. And even if we take care of this, Tom, the problem you identify of a terrible inequality, we redistribute income, that might be a necessary idea and a great idea. It only deals with the need. And to a couple of our earlier callers, they were talking about the other things that work gives you, a sense of dignity, a sense of what you're supposed to be doing on this world. And that's tremendously important as well.
But those things can collapse in a hurry if there's no money in the sugar bowl to buy groceries. Yeah. Sandy in Middlebury, Vermont. Sandy, you're on the air.
Thank you. My idea is that the issue isn't really about people being displaced from their jobs. It's about our finding a satisfactory way of distributing the wealth, not the income, but the wealth that's generated by this technology. Technology has been used traditionally to relieve us of the labor of that's involved in survival and seeking stimulation. And if we were to come up with a system in which the wealth is distributed among the population, and those who wish to work and pursue and be more creative can be compensated appropriately, yet everyone else has their basic needs for survival and stimulation and whatever else met as a result of the labor of our machines, why not do it that way?
Sandy, we'll talk about that. This is very important, but let me just ask you, while we've got you, how do you keep people, in that case, you know, incented to like be off their duff and out doing things? I mean, we know humans have needs and we respect that, but we also know they have kind of weaknesses toward, you know, sloth if there's no need to work for it. How do we restructure here so that we move the wealth around a little bit but not turn everybody into, you know, couch potatoes all the time?
Well, the happiest thing I ever did in my life, which I did 10 years ago, was retire. I have not had to work for 10 years, and yet I'm very busy having lots of fun. It's the best thing that ever happened to me, and it beats work. It really does.
There's testimony. He's testifying. So we hear it.
Well, that's an appealing vision. Unfortunately, we're not wealthy enough yet where everyone can retire and have machines take care of us. And I can imagine sometime, you know, 50 years in the future, where we'll be a lot closer to that kind of...
Let's examine that for a second. Mm-hmm. You say we're not wealthy enough for that. Well, we're a very wealthy country, as you've also pointed out. Now, I'm not a redistribution guy on its face, but if you don't have jobs, you've got hundreds of millions of people, and you don't have enough jobs for them, and the technology is concentrating wealth in a few hands, we may have to think this through. I mean, Sandy makes a point. I've got a couple more here. You know, Tina says, only good for those with dividends and those brilliant enough to work in Silicon Valley. And because it's good for the first group, they will not feel compelled to figure out what only humans can do. She's not confident that crowdsourcing is going to work because the people with the big megaphones aren't incented to, they don't care necessarily if it's figured out. Let me put one more on the table. Megan writes, the conversation up to this point is assuming the inevitability of the robot takeover of the workforce. Is there not a point at which we decide that jobs for human beings are more important than increasing the corporate bottom line and concentrating even more wealth at the top 1%? I don't know.
But I don't think we could turn off the spigot of digital innovation even if we wanted to.